Welcome everyone to the Badgers podcast with me, James Bledge, and
Sam Cooper.
It's been a while. This is we're revisiting a popular part of the podcast. It was a question answer session where we've put questions out on Instagram and Twitter.
This was actually, can you believe it, Bledge, when it's just me and you, this is probably one of our most listened to podcasts, the first version of this.
Excellent. So this is why we've cracked on to do it again. So
all you sad people out there want to listen to us.
What's happened? But we've got a change in drinks today. I'm a little bit hungover after being trawled across the town yesterday by Flight Lieutenant Luke Hopper, Sean from Birkdale, and our kid, John from Wallasey, and Nick Smits. And so I'm on the shandies today, Sam. And it's something that is actually
He's brought his own lemonade.
I've brought my own mixer here because this week, last Sunday we played with John McLaughlin.
Morrison's own brand.
Yep, it's just a cheap stuff.
Couldn't stretch the Schweppes.
But I'm actually pushing, I mean, if you want to comment on the lager, Sam, feel free while I pour.
Beautiful Tiger.
Tiger, one of the best, about. Oh, and it's, I mean, when you dilute it down as well, it just goes so much further. You get more bang for your buck, really. So, but the reason being, last week we sat out in the terrace at Hoy Lake, and John says, I'll have a pint of lager shandy. So I was like, wow, I've never had one of them for years. So I thought I'd join him, and I had a Caesar salad.
For those wondering where John's from, he's actually from Liverpool.
I had a Caesar, although that accent might say different, but we've Caesar salad and a shandy, and it was an
absolute delight.
Changed
your life.
And I don't know if it made me play better, but I think it was the key to something. So this is what I'm about now. You've got a brew dog, punk IPA.
Maybe no carbs is the answer to good golf.
Mm.
I remember...
It fattens you up, doesn't it? And you can't swing properly.
I was at Sunningdale on Monday. Played the old and the new, beautiful day. Absolutely, the greens were electric. They've got the Brabazon this week, so they were in great form. And I remember James Day of Urban Golf and Sounder fame. Brilliant James Day. I remember him saying that he goes to the halfway house and gets the naked sausage.
Because
he couldn't have the piece of bread because you feel it by the 12th hole.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think that one piece of bread has ever been noticeable with all of the wheat that I consume.
And did you try it that time, did you?
Oh, no, I still went with bread.
They have their little...
not an animal.
Pack lunch boxes, don't they, where they pull the bread out of one half buttered, one half not buttered, one half brown, white. That was a delight, the Sunningdale halfway house.
One of the great spots.
But I'm just a pure sausage, I'm the same as James. We should be good doubles partners, actually.
Athletes.
He's a hell of a golfer as well, so.
Athletes.
But, have you had a good week, Sam? Tell us what you've been up to.
Yeah, good week. Busy finishing a few course reports. As I say, I was at Sunningdale on Monday. Played 36 holes there, which is always, as I say, absolute delight. And then back up the road, went to sort of North Yorkshire to visit a course over there, and then back home, then back over to near Manchester to visit a course there. Just places we're talking to, and then been working frantically, finishing course report that I'm really excited to get out to Scottish Golf Club, which we'll be publishing soon. So all systems go at the moment.
And can we talk about Spey?
Oh, Spey Bay, yeah. So we announced that during the week. So for those that missed that one, Spey Bay, it's actually a really interesting story. So it's a golf course up near Lossiemouth, northeast Scotland, about an hour from Inverness, an hour, 10 minutes-ish from Aberdeen, so almost in the middle there. And it's a links course, but it's not a normal links course. It's a bit like Hayling, actually. It's on shale, but pure shale, like pebbles, really, big pebbles. And they've compacted over the years. So it's a really linear landforms. I kind of imagine, I don't know how it formed, but I guess it was something like the sea pushes the shales up and stacks the rows. And whereas then the wind, if that was sand, the wind would blow it and knock it about and you get all of these random shapes. Mm-hmm. The wind's not knocking loose
no,
stones over. So they stay in the really delineated form. So it's a really interesting sight. And then also, you know, it heats up in the summer. And I'd not thought of this, but the stone stores the heat. And then does that stop the, you know, the grass, I guess, can't really grow on top then?
Well, I mean, roots will, I guess, struggle to survive when if it's too warm for them down there. But I wouldn't imagine the heat being that substantial.
But I mean, it gets, like, stored in the stones. Mm. So rather than, you know, the ground being, the further down you go, the ground gets colder. Mm. Or more consistent in temperature, because over time, with the long summer days, the sun shining on it, it actually stores some of the heat in the stone. And
the moisture
loss
will be absolutely massive, yeah. You know.
But it's a really interesting sight.
I hope your budget to put in a good irrigation system there.
Well, Chris Haspel's working with us on that one, so we've got a good.
Top bloke. Not sure if he listens to this, but he's a fantastic greenkeeper, really good guy.
Yeah, well, looking forward. That'll be the first time I've worked with him. So, yeah, it's Frank and I have done some fun routings, and I think we've kind of explained, so there's no harm in saying. Basically, the site's covered in gorse at the moment. It's about 150-ish acres, but about 40 acres, maybe 50 acres actually, are gorse. So it's just grown and grown and grown over the years. And the good thing is, I suppose, from the stone is, the roots haven't gone down deep, so it's the roots are only shallow, so getting it out hopefully won't be a massive problem.
Mm-hmm.
But our idea and what we pitched to Lynx Dow, or Lynx Club now, as they styled themselves, they're lovely, lovely, lovely guys based in New York, and they set up this crypto thing to buy a golf course, and they got all these people, they raised a ton of money, and they've done it now. They've bought Spebe, and they're given us the backing and the confidence to go and propose something a little radical. And as I say, so by the time we've got rid of a lot of the gorse, not all of it, but a lot of it, the landscape, those stones have left a landscape where the contours are so sharp. It's actually really interesting. You don't need tons and tons of bunkers and things. You can make it interesting by tucking pins and the short grass with the really firm, rock-hard playing surfaces, the ball bouncing around. So we sort of pitched this short grass playground for Lynx golf enthusiasts, you know, people who get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think their members are. So they'll be able to come play not just one routing. So there's the current way round, which we can improve slightly, but by the time you strip the gorse out, you can actually play the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we build a few more greens, because there's some great green sites that they're not using, if we can build a few more greens, rather than just replace them and still end up with 18, we'll probably end up with a few more than that. And Frank and I have produced 7 different routings.
All right, well.
So over 20-something holes, depends which one we go for, but let's say 22 holes. We think you could play at least 6 or 7 different routings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's going to be trade-offs between, you know, the more routings you have, the more fairway you need, and to get some texture across the site with heather, because they've got heather on the site, bit of gorse to add some height to the surrounds, especially in screening, bit of marum grass, you know, some different textures, so it's not just entirely, you know, you can have 150 acres of short grass, as cool as some people might find that.
And is it triple SI?
No, not triple SI. So it's a really, I think it will be unique.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not unique globally. I'm trying to think. There must be somewhere it's doing something similar. The original sheep ranch before Bill and Ben came in and changed that was something vaguely similar, where it was more like cross-country golf.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the philosophy here, but with these different routings. So, as I say, I think we'll probably end up with, let's see, probably more than one routing anyway.
Is it a timeline?
We're hoping to get started this year, back end of this year. But it depends, you know, those things are still up in the air at the moment. The Americans, they want to push on.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get it going. But, you know, if you just try and compete with such a rich part of the world for golf, if you try and compete with Dornoch and Castle Stewart, the second course they're building there. Nairn's a great golf course. In the other direction, you know, Trump's building a second course. down at his place, and you've got Cruden Bay, you've got Royal Aberdeen. It's amazing.
It's a hot spot for golf now up there, you know.
So if we just tried to make a golf course that was 18 holes conventional stand to compete alongside those guys, then we'd be up against it, because the land's brilliant for what we're proposing, but it's not the massive sand dunes of Fraserburgh or Cruden Bay or Trump or those kind of places. So, it was more of a play to your strengths. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so Rank and I have done all these routings. Clates is coming over to look at it in July, which will be good fun. Week of the Open, so he's starting the week up there and then coming down to Hoylake. And Mike DeVries will be doing the construction, building the greens, all that kind of stuff. So that'll be the first time he's worked in the UK.
Yeah, wow. This is your first kind of big project then, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. It's basically a new golf course.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite, but... And there'll be a lot of elements of the existing golf course, but the fact that we can do then other routings means that there will be ways of holes that are created that have never been played there before, which should be good fun.
And will there be a website that people can check up the progress, or is that something thought about yet? Or
I would say that if anyone is on social media, the links DAO being DAO, that's a great place to look at it, because they're putting a lot of content out there.
All right, okay.
And as I say, it's this new decentralized way of building a golf club. So all of the members, typically the people who bought into us in the first place, almost by definition, they're young and they're tech savvy and they're not your typical golf club members. So it'll be interesting to see what difference that will make, but it's certainly a unique project.
Excellent. Well, you've been a busy boy then. I know that. Because we've not been able to do this as much, and we've fired through two rounds now of our club knockout, which has been good as well.
Yeah, we're still going. 18th.
Still going.
Just about.
But is there a prize for this if we do manage to get to the final?
Yeah. It's a big deal. Not if we get to the final and lose, you know. Got to go all the way.
Won't happen.
But so far, so good. Yeah.
It's been a winning formula.
Played nicely.
I think we need to discuss our tactics, though. I'm hitting too many drives.
No, it's spot on. Don't break the winning formula.
So, yeah.
But come on, Badge. People are more interested about your last few weeks, because the golf course at Hoylake now is unrecognisable to what it normally is.
It completely is. I think it's really cool when you show people around now, because you drive around the corner from my house... you get to the eighth green, and then it hits you like a freight train. You know, the stand behind six is so big. There's a back-to-back stand behind
that's massive.
12 and 13, which is really cool.
And they did build it around that tree that we were
they
talking
did,
about.
They did, we thought they were going to. Yeah, we knew they wouldn't. We said we didn't want the tree coming out, so it was. It's getting built around it, which is great to see. It's a beautiful kind of sprawling Scots pine.
It's like the one tree on the golf course.
But it's a beautiful looking tree. Yeah. You know, like it's a good backdrop. I do like Scots pine on a golf course. I'm a fan. And speaking of which, is it Bernard House? Is it the Dutch Open this week?
Bernardus. Yeah,
Bernardus.
Bernardus.
Is that how you
pronounce it?
That looks incredible. Kyle Phillips.
It does look good.
On sand, great sand areas in between the holes that are colonised with fescue and whatever else, and loads of little lovely Scots pine, lone pines everywhere. So, really.
Do you know what I like saying about that? You know, as someone who goes on about this stuff on a daily basis, is the fact that you won't see the same bunker or a bunker either side of the fairway at the same yardage.
No, right.
They're all staggered. It's all about the asymmetry. It's all about good side and the bad side, and it's just nice to see a tour event actually on a golf course like that, because
it's
you don't see it often.
Proper golf course to watch, whereas usually, I don't know, quite a lot of them bore me a little bit. You know, it's not about the golf course. It's usually about, I don't know, if the money you spend to host an event or whatever, and then you get this course that crops up out of nowhere in Holland, and it looks just awesome. And I've been enjoying watching that. In fact, Hoylake member Matthew Jordan was sitting third when we were watching when we came up, was that right?
Yeah, I don't think the back nine has gone as well as it started, but great week for Matthew.
Yeah.
He had a bit of an injury, so
it's good to see him playing well again.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been all systems go. It's not rained for quite a substantial amount of time.
It's getting brown, isn't it?
Yeah, but we're trying not to get it too brown. You know, we want to kind of keep it green, so we've got divot recovery. It's a bit early for it to be going brown, so we have been watering. The rough was growing, and that'll probably stall a little bit now, you know, because it's dry. But I mean, it only takes one big dump of rain. The good old stuff, you know, the good. There's such a difference between irrigation water and rainwater. You know, it comes with a lot more added benefits. The nitrogen that's in the actual rainwater.
That's interesting.
Isn't it? I think someone told me it's about 10 kilograms a hectare of nitrogen a year.
Really?
You get out your rainwater. I don't know how you go about measuring that, but
I guess that's why you've got to cuss and collect and take it away. Ripping it out.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it just gets thicker and greener and lusher.
So what you can add on to your, when someone, say you've put 60 kilograms on your greens a year, it might be nearly 70. But as I say, I think we need to kind of look more into that. But that's what I had heard. Everything else, the greens, it was a club championship yesterday at Hoylake, and I think everyone was fairly happy with the place. We're just refining now. We're grooming the greens every week. Bit of work to do and some of the kind of tidying bunkers up, whatever, in the weeks running up to it. But yeah, we're all kind of sitting nice, and it'll start to get hectic soon, I think. But we're doing a lot of media work, really. A lot of interviews, a lot of written interviews. We did United NBC the other day, which was interesting.
Yeah.
In front of a proper film. I was on a film set, actually. Some of the cameras they were using, I'd never seen the likes.
No, it was serious, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Into the little card room in the clubhouse where they were filming it.
Actually, they made me do a Scouse accent as well, which...
doesn't normally take much prompting. You've already done one today.
I know. And I did National Club Golf
style.
One last week as well, which I did the same again. Sorry, John. But...
Poor John.
I will mature in time. all good there. And got another couple of weeks of dry weather coming up. So it's really about fine-tuning. We've got a new Cirrus Pro Rainbird software, which is great. We can go onto the course with our iPad, stand right over the head, dial the fairway heads up and down if we need, add programs. And it's just a lot more controllable now than we had before with the Nimbus. So tomorrow, for example, some of the boys are going out playing golf. I'll just tag along at 11:30 and walk 118 with the iPad and just check that everything's where we want it to be. If the heads are all right percentages, there's quite a lot of heads we've got running just now at 150%, 200% on certain fairways. So when we fairway water, we put on 4 mil. So these areas, selected areas, we're getting 8 just because there's so much dry and try and get that evenness. What I don't want it doing, if it does brown off a wee bit, I don't want bits browning off faster than the others.
I saw you out hand watering, or the guys out hand watering the other day.
Yeah, we were doing like bunker edges, any of the turfed areas that we put down this year. You could chuck a lot of guys on hand watering. It really is absolute key to being hand watering like fairy rings and fairways, so they don't get any worse than they are already. There's a lot of work to be done just now, but we're keeping on top of it, and it's looking promising.
Well, we're going to come to some of the questions, but I've got a couple before we start, because I do find it interesting, Bledge. How do you manage the likes of the club championship at Hoylake and the spring meeting and the big competitions that the members care about with open preparation?
Because I was asked this actually the other day, and because... our philosophy as a team is to have the golf course set up to club championship standard all the time. When it came yesterday, the only difference we did was we painted the holes and we changed the flags. You know, we'd said midweek that the hole pins were, the positions were going to be a little bit tougher. There was a couple of sneaky ones in there because it is the best players at the club that are playing. But apart from that, the prep's not really any different. We feel we give the members a really high level of setup every weekend. Every weekend the greens are cut, rolled. The holes are done, the bunkers are all raked, you know, it's looking tidy. So yeah, and to be honest with you, you want it like that no matter if it was Johnny bringing his mates for a four ball, you know, and he wants to have the same conditions on that Saturday it would be for club championships, and we're trying our best to achieve that.
Yeah, well, it clearly is, you know, it's immaculate at the moment, so
It's good. While ago, we could actually do with the opening 2 weeks, to be honest. It's quite far away still.
Well, the other question I have is kind of about irrigation. So often I'll hear, you know, I'm a big proponent of the running game and fast and, you know, being able to bounce the ball in and that kind of stuff. And often I'll hear members talking to, you know, when a club's looking at bringing in a new irrigation system, and they'll say, oh, they're just going to overwater it. It's going to be green. It's going to be lush. It's not going to bounce. The grasses are going to change. What would you say for that, about having the control to be the master of your destiny?
I mean, it's an irrigation system, something you can't do without. It's a fact. If especially somewhere like here, I mean, it's geographical, I guess. You know, some places get away with it more than others. And there's places that do produce great fairways without irrigation. But if you really want to achieve the very best and take away the stress, you need a really good functioning irrigation system. And it's up to the course manager to use that sensibly and not go off his rocker by overwatering everything. It's all down to checking moistures all the time. Running sensible applications at sensible times of night when there's no wind, having all your arcs set properly. It's really, an irrigation system's got to be fine-tuned for it to get the most out of it. The amount of water you could save by just spending a lot of time looking at it, looking at how it's behaving, and choosing the right times to do it. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know too many people that go mental with irrigation systems and just lash water on. You know, I think we're very well educated, most guys these days, to use our irrigation systems and use it sensibly and not get themselves into trouble with it.
Do you think that you walked off the green when we played our Summer Foursomes match the other day, and someone had left a bottle of water by the putting green?
Yeah.
And you started, we thought you'd lost the plot, really, until you explained, and you were pouring it out here, there, and checking the absorption rate, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, if you've got an irrigation system, what else do you do to manage the water?
Well, it's just exactly, I mean, checking surface tension, you know. It's like pouring pouring a bottle of water on a coral sponge, you know, the one that's been dry for weeks in the bath, and you pour it on, it just runs off. You know, it's checking when your wetting agents are due to be applied next. And sometimes, I mean, we apply monthly, but you're lucky sometimes.
So you adjust it based on what you see.
Yeah, exactly. So you would, I mean, even though we apply monthly, you might want to, in week 3 to 4, start hand watering with a gun, with a wetting agent tablet in it, because it could well have run out by then. I mean, I kind of find quite often when it's as hot as this, it degrades so fast, I mean, that you might find it only lasts 3 weeks. So you've really got to watch out.
So it's not only greenkeepers and course managers who listen to this. So wetting agents, for those who don't know, what's the idea there?
It's a surfactant, like a fairy liquid, a very expensive fairy liquid, all come in different molecule formulations, block copolymers, reverse block copolymers, linear polymers where the water sticks to. So basically, it's like stickers and strippers. You have one blend of wetting agent that allows the water molecule to stick to the soil molecule, and the other one, the stripper that strips the waxy coating off the soil molecule that causes a hydrophobicity. How do you say that? Hydrophobicity.
Yeah. Nailed it.
Yeah, so the water can get pulled through, and quite a lot of blends, like we use Qualibra, it blends both types, and so you get the water pulling its way through the soil profile evenly, and it holds on to the moisture, so it's not like it pulls it right through. In the winter, you might want to use like a penetrant that just pulls the water straight through. So you can blend them. John at Wallasey, he uses Ors, AHS and PS, which is exactly that. The HS is the sticker and the PS is the stripper, the penetrant, and blends them depending on what the weather's like. So the great thing about wetting agents, sometimes you don't really see them working, but you know fine well they work, because when it does rain, the soil's re-wet. You know, the water doesn't run off. And I mean, a great example would be like crowns of turf. So, you know, like you have like hilly fairways and you'll have like a, the crown will be burnt off and the low bit will be lush.
Yeah.
Because when the water's, when it's getting watered, when there is the rain, the water just runs right off there and down into the low bit. Whereas if you've got a wetting agent on, there's more chance of it getting soaked into the crowns and getting used because it doesn't run down because the surface tension has been released. But it's, I mean, you could get right into it. There's so, I think there's about 80 or 90 different wetting agents in the, available across the world for us to buy. So I've been with the same one for 9 years now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Okay, well, should we get into some of these questions?
Crack on, yeah, let me ask you.
Very kindly being sent in to us.
I'll ask you one. Well, I'll start off.
Okay.
Right. Ruri Kiri. Ruri, I can't even speak today. It's this shandy. It's not strong enough. Ruri Kiri has asked, Sam, what is the best Open Championship course, past and present?
Oh, good, Rory. Well, Rory's a member down at Deal, and that's a pretty good one. You know, if we're talking past and present, you know, the ones that aren't present anymore, what are they? Musselburgh, Prestwick. Deal, Princes. That's this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really good golf courses out of those. I love Prestwick, love Deal. Princes has changed beyond all recognition in recent years, and Musselburgh is good fun. Everyone's got to go there and see it and make the trip to the race course to play at Musselburgh. But for me, I'm boring when I answer this question because I love strategic golf, and the best examples of strategic golf are still Muirfield and the Old Course.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think the Old Course is so interesting is everyone can like it. You don't have to be a real sad git like me to love the Old Course and the nuance and what's on the ground. Even if you have no interest in that at all, you can go to the Old Course and like the history and the drama and the sense of occasion and the butterflies on the first tee when you try and hit the biggest fairway in the world. You know, those things are still special, irrespective of the architecture. Everyone can love them. But I do think it's the best. And the reason why, two reasons. Number one, I don't think that the Old Course is the course it is because of golf. I would argue that golf is the way it is because of the Old Course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where they played. That's where the game in those formative years evolved. And it was almost like if golf in those early years had been played somewhere else, perhaps the game we play today would look completely different from how it is. So that was ground zero, and the game evolved, and then the courses that were then built afterwards are versions of the Old Course. The best ones ask questions in the way the Old Course asks questions, but perhaps not by design in the first instance, just by coincidence more than anything else. So I think that's a special reason. But also I think it's really overlooked. You know, people would say, oh, if you take away the history, if you take away the town, it's a really overrated golf course. Loads of people say that, isn't it? I'm getting better at resisting the urge to go into full defensive mode. But I like to illustrate the point by saying, if you look at the back nine of the Old Course and you said, right, okay, what's the best par three on the open rotor? What's the best short par four? What's the best medium par four? What's the best long par four? What's the best par five? You know, it's also there probably five whole types, shall we say, that you're always going to find. And then what's the one of the most iconic holes? You know, what's a hole that everyone knows, that everyone gets excited to play? Well, you can make a strong case, I think, that all of them are on the back nine of the Old Course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 11th is one of the great par threes on the Old Course, on the open rotor.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the 13th Alps at Hoylake is another great hole. And you know, the 6th at Royal St George's, the Maiden Hole is a famous hole, and Calamity at Portrush is a famous par 3, and 16 also at Carnoustie. They're great par 3s as well, but it's at least in the same conversation as mm-hmm. those. Best short par 4, well, you know, the 12th on the Old Course is pretty good as a short par 4. To be able to ask all of these different questions and give half a dozen different ways, you can hit almost any club off that tee. And that, for me, variety, mm-hmm. not just in hole types, but how you can play each hole, that's a hallmark of great design. So the 12th is a great short par 4. And there aren't really too many short par 4s on the open rotor. Perhaps the 3rd at Carnoustie, that's probably my favourite as a short par 4 on the open rotor. But, you know, the 12th on the old course is well and truly in that conversation. Mm-hmm. Then medium length par 4. 16th at the old course, you're not looking past that. You know, you've got the principal's nose, one of the great centerline features in architecture. Do you go between the principal's nose and the railway track to get the line into the green, or do you go left of it? And then good luck trying to get close to that pin if it's sort of between the, or just past the the greenside bunker. You know, that's, as a medium length par 4, it really is as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. Long par 4s, you've got some good examples. The 4th at Royal St. George's is one of the best long par 4s that you'll find anywhere, but it's not as good as the road hole. The road hole is as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. And then par 5, you know, the 14th. The 14th, again, there's the famous Spirit of St. Andrews essay that Alistair McKenzie wrote about 4 different ways of playing the hole. And then he actually talks about a 5th then when Bobby Jones would, when it was downwind and firm, I think it was in an amateur championship, and he would play down the Elysian fields down the right hand side between the Beardies bunkers and the outer bounds down the right, and then he'd try and not hit the green, but actually, if it was downwind, get past the green, because the green's then pitched front to back, so it was an easier up and down from going long. But between all of the configurations of bunkers, out of bounds, pitch of the green, right to left kickers if you're on the approach, if you play your layup right of hell bunker down the Elysian fields, you know, that is a one of the great par fives in terms, again, of the variety of different ways of playing it. And then iconic holes, God, it doesn't get better than the 18th, does it? Yeah. So I think the old course for me still remains unmatched as, you know, as a golf course that everyone can play, get excited about, whether they care about the things that I've just described or not. But the more you play it, the more you get into it, the more you appreciate these things, you kind of have these oh shit moments that it's like, actually, that's an amazing hole. And I hadn't quite appreciated it first time round because I made my bogey or a par because I hold a person and I walked off. But if you want to play those holes really well, then you have got to be really good.
I agree. I think it's a superb golf course. It's probably up there with, it could well be the best that I've played. Certainly the best golf experience I've ever had. So it's something I'll never forget. But I completely agree with you. I'd love to get back and play Muirfield again though as well.
Yeah, Muirfield again is special.
I played it years ago when there was no rough and it was the middle of winter. And
well, they do have quite a lot of rough. That's the one thing you would say. But in terms of those green complexes and having to think your way around the golf course, you scarcely find a better bunker golf course than Muirfield. You know, the bunkers are always there. Whenever you think, oh, I want to be down the left here because the pin's cut front right, there's a bunker there.
And they're super undulating into them as well. They're shortcut undulating into them, and they don't have like high revetting walls and quite a lot of them as well. So they're very original. It's a super place.
Well, let's ask you a question. Pledge. So the Open's coming, it's now only a couple of months away, but it's not going to be too long until it's actually gone. And then you've got as much work to do reinstating the golf course after that. So Harry Middleton from Hayling wants to know about what your plans are for reinstating the golf course during the derig process.
Excellent. So I guess it all depends on the weather during the time. If it's going to be dry, then there'll be a lot less reinstating to do than there would be if it was to be wet. You know, wet plus traffic equals mud, essentially, probably, you know. And
even at Hoylake, even when it's proper sandy,
it could get pretty messy. Not muddy because it's sand, I guess, but I mean, a lot of foot traffic, it could get quite churned up. I mean, you're talking, what did they say, 260,000 people through the week or something?
262, yeah.
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of bottlenecks and stuff, so we just have to kind of take stock afterwards. I'm pretty sure with a lot of these infrastructure areas where, where all the grass will be dead. It'll be a case of maybe just getting the vet to drain out, getting some air into the soils, maybe overseeding the worst of the parts. But it'd be interesting with the seed bed that's there. It's been there for hundreds of years to see what comes back naturally. But we will be in close contact with Bob Taylor, our ecologist, and Sophie, and we'll come up with a plan afterwards.
What about things like the, you know, the nuts and bolts and the nails and the screws and all that kind of stuff? Because
they do have a magnet that goes in the back of a tractor that goes around and picks up everything, and it'll be really down to the volunteers and people employed to pick up litter as well to kind of make sure that it's scoured. I would like to think in most of these areas where there might be nuts and bolts or screws left, then they are going to be in long rough, and it's not the kind of areas we're going to be cutting with a fairy mower anyway. So
yeah,
we should be right enough.
Shout out to the WDC, you know, get Danny Power down there with his metal detector.
Do you want to explain the WDC, Sam, for our listeners?
We digress again. It never takes long. The WDC is not a metal detecting group. It's our lunching dining society. Yes. But we've got to have an excuse to tell. So we got some camo fleeces and one of our number bought a metal detector, and we watched Detectorists. Have you ever watched? You watched Detectorists?
Never seen it. No.
You never watched Detectorists? Yeah. It's great. Nothing happens, but it's brilliant. It's just funny.
It's like I sit and watch Jenny watching The Curse of Oak Island. Every episode, they're getting near the gold. They never get near it. It's the biggest waste of time ever.
No, it's great.
I can't believe she gets excited by it.
Toby Jones and Mackenzie Crook and Simon Farnaby and some of the best.
I like him.
No, you should watch that. Yeah. There'll be some listeners out there.
So yeah, we might get some metal detectors, but I think that the golf course itself, I mean, it'll just be crossing routes. I would have thought, you know, where the traffic's crossing the fairways. Overseeding work, but yeah, let's just see what the weather brings. The weather's the answer to everything there.
I wonder what the best thing you'll find will be afterwards. We'll have to come back to the listeners on that, see if you find anything. Someone's dropped
probably a body,
diamond ring or something.
Someone that's drunk too much Stella on the Sunday night. Find them in a gorse bush.
That's why you recommend the shandies.
Yes, well, that's a changed man. So let's ask you one now. Let's go back and forward. Do you look at golf courses differently now, Sam, that you're in the industry? And that's from our friend Matt Plested from Stoneham.
Oh, good old
best
Matt.
Best greenkeeper on the planet.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of those where it kind of creeps up on you without... It's not like you flick a switch and then you start looking at it differently. I think that one thing I've noticed now is a greater appreciation of just playing golf with my mates. Doesn't matter where it is. Having good company, good weather,
mm-hmm.
playing half decently, having a nice time, and not really focusing so much on the architecture of the golf course, because that's what I do all day, every day. I don't really switch off from that because I love it. You know, that is, I'm so lucky that is my passion. That's what I do. I think that it's nice to have a bit of a break, and you appreciate then that whilst the architecture is so important because people will enjoy good architecture, whether they appreciate it or not, people will enjoy good architecture. They'll enjoy a course that's well designed.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, you know, golf is a social game for me. So I think that being able to turn off a bit, and the more I've played, the more I've got into the architecture, the more I've appreciated that sort of slight delineation, actually. But yeah, I would say it crept up over time. I was probably more like that to start with. And then the more courses I played, the more I got into it, the more I started noticing these things, the more I did start to look at the golf courses differently. But now it's also nice to just have a break from that and just enjoy it with your mates.
Mm-hmm. It's the same with greenkeeping, I guess. You could go out and just get too strung out with thinking about turf all the way around and forget why you love golf in the first place. You know, it's about the clubs and scrambling your way around the golf course. But I completely agree with that.
Excellent. We're finally in agreement.
Finally.
Let's stick on the theme of the Open. Biggest challenge with the Open prep. Two people wanted to know that, and that was Graham Royden, but also Caleb Overhill. And he's got a second part to the question that I'll ask afterwards.
Okay. Graham, great, great guy, top greenkeeper down at Royal St. George. So, biggest challenge. I think just now it's really this far out, managing the golf course. We've hit a kind of a little bit of a mini heat wave. It's not too hot, but it's very dry and it's a bit windy. The evapotranspiration's right up. It's zapping all the moisture out of fairways.
When was the last time it rained?
Oh, it must have been 3 weeks ago now, I think.
You need to do a rain dance pledge. It never rains in Hoylake.
I know.
You've come up from rainy Kent to the dry part of the country.
This is what Sean was saying yesterday. Like, everyone keeps saying, oh, you know, you're moving up north. It's wet all the time up there. It's not at all. At all. But I don't think it's rained really since I put a new weather station in, so it'd be interesting to see. I can actually bring up my live data. I might have had a little bit of rain, but I can bring that up right now. We're 6 weeks out, 7 weeks out, and the fairways are starting to kind of dry out a little bit. I mean, we're using quite a lot of water to keep them wet. And obviously, we're right on top of our wetting agents, but I still need to keep any divots outside of the mat zone, still need to keep them growing, still need to keep the definition up because we had beautiful definition between the fairway and the rough. So, yeah, it's managing that water budget.
It's amazing how quickly it turns at Hoylake, isn't it? From green to brown and then brown to green back again.
So 26.2... mil we've had, and I think that's since when did I have that put in? March, I think, maybe April.
That's like
April, so it's not much at all. Maybe it's not
two
much,
two and a half plus,
yeah, hardly anything. So, I obviously can't use my whole water budget before then, but I know how much I'm putting out per night on certain parts, and then I can work out how much the maximum amount I can put down. Until then, but we'll be fine. We've actually used less water this year than we did last year because last year was so dry.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't rain at all in February, March and April and May. Like nothing.
Yeah.
Whereas at least we had a little bit in the spring. We had a bit of a wet spring, but now it's just kind of falling right off the edge of the cliff because it's been so dry. But like no one knows. You know, the golf course still looks unreal. It's the fairways still look green, but it's the challenge is, and that's the answer to the question, the challenge is keeping them that way up until they open so they're nice and healthy. And then when the open comes, then we can rein back and say, okay, we can speed it up now. We can dry it out. If it is going to be dry, we can dry it out. And that's the way it should play.
We've talked a bit about irrigation and you've just given an answer about rain that's included rainfall. Is it worth just talking about water in general? Because it's something that always crops up in my line of work, you know, accounting for the water source on the golf course, reservoirs versus boreholes versus mains water. And I think there's that crazy stat that I can't remember the number, but like way more are off the mains feed than perhaps should be.
And it's absolutely extortionate. Mains feed. I mean, I think someone had said the other day it's between £1.40 and £1.80 a cubic metre.
Wow.
And we'll put out 500 cubic metres tonight on the fairways, which is 4 millimetres. 4 millimetres is a half decent day's rain, really, to describe to you what 4 millimetres is. Ideally, you would water heavier and less frequent, but I've got an irrigation tank. I don't have a reservoir, so I can put out the maximum I can put out with the ball valve filling it at night is probably 550 or 600 probably.
And at the moment we have a borehole, but then you're restricted to how much you can actually take.
Yeah, so I'm allowed 28,000 cubic metres of water a year. So if you calculate that, it's probably, oh God, it's about £45,000 if you were to buy that on mains.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of an amount. So, I mean, a lot of these golf courses down Surrey all use mains. So we're lucky enough to have the borehole and we just pay for our licence. But we've been looking at other ways of farming water as well. So when the open's done and dusted, I've started projects in that already. When the open's done and dusted, we'll be looking at some CapEx projects, saving some water through drainage water, etc. So
yeah, and you know we've got half a plan for reservoir and stuff, haven't we? Which hopefully in the fullness of time might be viable.
Well, there's possible options maybe depending, but it's very difficult to fit something on our site. But I mean, we could always build other tanks, or you know, there's other ways forward. But we certainly, it would be nice to not have that figure of 28 over our head. You know, if you hit me with 30, I'd be a lot happier.
It's funny how one of the things that we're looking at when we're, you know, I would say Frank and I, we do a lot of sorts of rerouting tricky sites and things. That's, you know, strategic golf and rerouting tricky sites are probably some of the areas that most of the work across the world, but Europe especially, sort of falls to. And, you know, it's not just all about the historical stuff that we're, you know, well known for particularly liking. But it's funny from a resource management point of view, how you can combine those things with, if you're rerouting a bit of a site to solve whatever the reason might be, a practice ground, boundary issues, which is the case at a course I was at earlier in the week. But they have, as an example, a site where they have a boundary issue, but on a heavy soil site, it's actually one of the places where they have a vein of sand. So to incorporate, you know, a multitude of problems together and get a solution that maybe you can have a reservoir on a higher point of the site where you can take sand out of the ground. And if sand is, whatever, 54 pounds a ton or something at the moment.
45 or something, yeah. A lot.
So if sand is bloody expensive and everyone needs sand and it's a finite and limiting resource, and at the same time you can solve these issues, it's the great value of looking at holistically as a site rather than saying, right, we've got a problem here with boundary, let's just move the fairway over, and then, you know, you pull one thing and something else moves on the other side of the golf course. You know, that might have an impact for, you have to move a tee because the tee is now close to where people are hitting their drives, and then that means that something else changes and that causes a problem further us. You know, we are such advocates of a master plan across a site, because if you can fix the problem properly once and for all, but at the same time, you know, maybe look at your water source.
Other jobs, yeah.
You can also look at how you can take sand out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things I think are interesting and only going to become more of a feature in recent incoming years when, you know, resource management is so key.
Mm-hmm. What you're talking about there, about sand mining and stuff, you know, it actually made me think. I did a little calculation the other day, and we had mined 4,000 tons of sand from the dunes last year. That would have cost me £180,000 to buy, and it would have, our carbon footprint would have been
lorries up and down the M6.
Well, the nearest dune sand I think was Hugh King's in Ayrshire. I think it's quite a lot of very popular place for dune sand that has our spec. It would be 53,000 miles worth of lorry trips.
Oh my God.
So how great is that? You know, that we can use this sand, and there'll be sand there until my retirement, until my predecessor's retirement, sorry, my successor's retirement, and then probably three or four guys or girls after him. You know, there's a lot there we can use. So it is finite because there's only going to be so many years you can...
Well, finite also in terms of where, how many places you can get it from.
Exactly.
Like, it's not like you can just nip down to the beach with your bucket and spade and fill it up, is it?
No, not at all, because it's like salinity is a problem and stuff then. So, but there might be, in the future, there might be other ways of reducing organic matter. There might be a machine come out that zaps it all. Who knows? You just don't know. You know, there might be different ways of doing it.
Well, quickly then, I'll ask another question, because I think there'll be people listening who will say, well, that's all well and good, Bledge, but you must have the right kind of sand on site, because mine has too many fines, not enough fines. Yeah. It's not the right composition. I can't, my screener isn't big enough. You know, I don't have the practical ability to take it out. What would you say to those guys? How do you go about the process of working out if the sand is fit for your dressings, for your bunker sand?
Well, you'll get it tested at a place. I mean, we do our testing at ETL, European Turf Laboratories, up in Alloa. And yeah, there's a spec sheet that you run from with it. It tells you exactly how many fines and very fines and the percentage of silt and clays you should be avoiding. We're on the right side of that, unfortunately. I know that Neil at Southern S was saying that thinks it possibly he's got just too many fines. But you also, I mean, fines are good as well for bulk density, for firming up your surfaces. And that's exactly what creates your firms. And these sands, I mean, even though our sand's super fine here, it still drains really well, and it'll be all down to the shape of the sand as well. So it's not just about the size of the particle, but how it's shaped as well, and how water can percolate through these.
Interesting. And it doesn't blow out of the bunkers too much. And
that's the thing as well. You know, I think it's they changed the sand down at Southern S because it was so fine it blew out the bunkers. Ours does blow around the bunkers, but it's a small price to pay because it's a natural site. You want to use what's there in the bunker. It's like when people say, oh, there's too much sand in the bunkers. It's not possible because the sand goes down forever. So
that's funny. I think putting my architect and history hat on again, likening it back to Hoylake, it's funny how people would say, oh, the sand blows out of the bunkers, therefore the sand is too fine.
Mm.
Full stop. And it's like, well, is that the end of the conversation? Because if you look at an aerial of Hoylake from the 1930s, I think the oldest one we have is 1935. So everyone will have an aerial from between 1939 and 1945 because of the Second World War. But before 1940-ish, they tend to be a little rarer. But we've got a good one from the mid-30s, and it shows all of the work that Harry Colt did. He did a plan in 1924 and then implemented that up over the next sort of 5-8 years or so.
Mm.
So one of the things it shows is the bunker styles, because before then they were generally either scrapes, animal scrapes, you know, sort of, it was an old rabbit warren. So there were natural animal scrapes that were the bunkers, or they were typical Victorian things. They were cross bunkers, trenches. We have a lot of COPs, which are not KOP, but COP. COPs, which were sort of boundaries between different agricultural, not that they were growing things, but they would have been grazing stuff on the sandy dune land. So the COPs demarcated those parcels of land, and they would often be basically a trench that was dug, and then the spoil they took out was piled up. So you have these little high turf, 4 or 5 foot high turf walls, and they would have strip bunkers alongside them. And that was the early stuff from 1869 through to the 1920s. And then Colt was brought in. One of the aspects of his brief was actually to formalise the bunkers into what we would call bunkers today.
Mm-hmm.
And he built these beautiful natural, not revetted, but natural bunkers. Because, you know, bunkers on links courses were generally natural up until sort of after the Second World War, when people come back and start building the turf walls. So he built these bunkers. But one thing you notice if you study them is we have a pretty consistent prevailing wind at Hoylake. Comes down off the DS Street, past Hilbury Island, blows across the site. And when there was a long bunker, it would always be 90 degrees to the prevailing wind. It would never be down the prevailing wind.
Like a wind tunnel.
It would never be the wind tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And Colt clearly appreciated that. And he'd build a variety of bunkers, but they would be good for the play and they'd be good for the design of the holes. But they would also, you know, if it was a big bunker, it would probably be protected a bit by a hill. If it was a long bunker, it would generally be, as I say, perpendicular to the prevailing wind.
Mm-hmm.
And the variety in shapes that he got in the design of the bunkering in the 1920s was amazing, but he did it in an intelligent way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do it just by making, which unfortunately was a mistake that was made in the latter, you know, towards the end of the 20th century by an architect who did a hell of a lot of work across Britain, who liked kidney-shaped bunkers. And Hoylake built loads of kidney-shaped bunkers. But the same consideration to the prevailing wind or sitting them into the landscape wasn't, dare I say, given.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up with all these loads of kidney-shaped bunkers that were acting like wind tunnels. And I remember when I started playing golf when I was younger, we'd have bunkers where one half of the bunker, the sand would be up to your knee, and on the other side it would be
hard and compact, yeah,
absolutely compacted, and the wind had just blown us over, blown us out, all the rest of it. So the solution then is either one of two things. Generally, it's either change the sand to a coarser, heavier sand, or make every bunker a small circle, a small deep circle, so it doesn't blow around as much.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's kind of missing the point. It's like, well, there's a problem, but really, the solution isn't either of those things. The solution is just design your bunkering better for your site.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got to bring sand down the road and spend hundreds of thousands of pounds and pump all this carbon
and
out, maybe that's not the right answer.
And fill them all up and keep them topped up and use liners to separate what's underneath. And
it's a really good example of sort of penny pinching, not really having a proper plan. And then spending probably 10, 20 times the amount a plan would have cost in and the thousands of hours that go into maintaining something that you're always up against it from day one.
Well, bunkers are our biggest expense usually when it comes to every greenkeeper in the country will say the same. The most amount of staff used, the most amount of time used to maintain them, strim them, rake them.
Revet them.
Exactly. I mean, my whole team last year was taken up from a revetting bunkers, so I'm thinking we might do one or two this year if anyone that are damaged, but we might do none, and then it'll just be left to reinstate, and then the year after that we might nip off 10 or 20, and that's going to be amazing, because look at what else you can provide for the course then. So I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like to work here without having to do a load of bunkers.
Here's another false economy for you. Small bunkers, on the face of it, small circular bunkers require less revetting turf, easier to revet, but your ball's going to be under the face more often as a golfer, so you're going to hack more chunks out the face, so you're going to have to revet it more often.
Mm-hmm.
A slightly larger bunker, if you can't go, you know, if you can't go natural, then maybe it doesn't suit the site or the members won't go for it, whatever, fine. But if you're going to do it, maybe sometimes having a slightly larger bunker and a more considered approach will actually mean that you're not having as many chunks taken out, so you don't have to revet it as frequently.
And also, I mean, the bunker could be not just the size of the actual sand bunker itself, but everything around it, the catchment area.
Yeah.
So the bunker is essentially a lot bigger anyway without being bigger physically.
Well, there you go. There's yet another digression. Let's go back to the proper questions. Right. So, the Rye Life. What a place Rye is. The Rye Life wants to know, is it harder to manage a top-level golf course with the high expectations and the big budgets that go with it? Or is it actually harder to manage a low-level place where maybe the expectations are a little smaller, but the budgets are a lot smaller?
Okay, that's a great question. I've never managed a low-budget golf course. I've been very lucky. I've worked at plenty, yeah. I mean, Dumfries and Galloway, where I started off, and my good friend Stevie Cairns is the head greenkeeper there now, and I see exactly the hardships that Stevie goes through with that. I think they're both equally as hard, and for the reason as follows. High-budget golf course, expectations are high. People are paying our place, what's our green fee? $250 or something.
Plus, yeah.
They're paying that, so it's a bucket list game for them. It needs to be in Open Championship condition when they come and play it. And day in, day out, it's what you expect. If I was to go up to King's Barnes and play, you know, I'd be like, you'd hope it was in like top condition. So that's the pressure on there with a high budget. You have to perform. You can't ever let go. I mean, there might be some days where you're putting top dressing on, but then if you do that, it needs to be done so well that there's no disruption to anyone and well communicated. This is the heart. This is what makes that side of it hard. But I've got so much respect for the people on low budget golf courses that produce anything, because they've got to be a jack of all trades I'm in the privileged position where one of my pumps goes down in the pump house, or there's like a problem in the course that I can't fault find and I can't find it. I know that the most efficient thing for me to do is to phone up Adrian Abbott at Abbott's and speak to him about it, get help from him. He might send someone up to have a look if we're really struggling. Whereas Stephen at Dumfries and Galloway Golf Club the other week, pumps weren't working, he had a leak in the course. It's like literally like finding a needle in a haystack. He had to do all that himself, you know. He has to, they don't have the money to just go and find somewhere. So masses of respect. And that just doesn't stop at irrigation. It goes on to fixing machines, for example. I mean, that's another, greenkeepers were not irrigation experts and quite a lot of us aren't mechanics either. But if you're in a one-man band, if you've got four or five staff and a low-budget golf course, you need to be. So, yeah, I think I would prefer to be where I am and have the luxury of being able to spend if I need to get us out of a hole. And I'm lucky to where it would be where I am, and I understand that. But the guys on the low-budget golf courses that do everything, hats off to them, you know, they're fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're good answer, Bledge, because it's different, isn't it? It's just completely, you know, like you say, you've got to be an expert in delegating and managing a team and communicating, which are skills that you've built up. You know, they don't all just come automatically, but, you know, you've built up such great ability in all of those things. But equally, to be able to go and fix pipes and program things and fix machines and to produce a great playable surface with no or very limited budget, far less than these guys would want. What an ability that is.
Aye, no, they're the real heroes, and you see it day in and day out, because there's a lot more low budget golf courses in Britain than there's high budget.
Yeah, so, the old pyramid.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. So, yeah, good on them. Good on them. There are better men than I am. So,
okay. Well, Ledge, I'm looking at the minutes ticking by here because we're already an hour in. Should we pause this?
Yep.
Maybe this could be part one.
Yep. Let's do that.
And then we could come back to part two.
Yep.
And because we've got a few more questions, so part two will probably be a bit shorter, but I'm sure people will like that.
Go and get yourself a cup of tea, a Blue Dog, Punk IPA, or a Tiger. And Morrison's lemonade shandy. And a Caesar salad. Excellent. We'll see you on the other side.
Thanks everyone for listening. Hope you're enjoying this extended question bit. And we'll be back with part two shortly.